Knights who had served in the Crusades were buried under stone effigies whose legs were crossed instead of sitting side by side, the mark of a holy crusader, so that all eternity could know that they'd served their time in God's name, wetting their swords in children's blood, raping anything that might have caught their lonely eyes, and stealing whatever wasn't set firmly in the ground. All sides. The Jews mainly as victims, but taking their part on the hilt end of the sword when they got the chance, because all men are alike in their virtues and vices. The bastards must have loved it, Jack thought bleakly, watching a traffic cop settling a dispute at a busy corner. There must have been some genuinely good men back then. What did they do? What did they think? I wonder what God thought. But Ryan wasn't a priest, or a rabbi, or an imam. Ryan was a senior intelligence officer, an instrument of his country, an observer and reporter of information. He continued looking around and forgot about history for the moment. The people were dressed for the oppressive heat, and the bustle of the streets made him think of Manhattan. So many of them had portable radios. He passed a sidewalk restaurant and saw no less than 10 people listening to an hourly news broadcast. Jack had to smile at that. His kind of people. When driving his car, the radio was always tuned to an all-news DC station. The eyes he saw flickered about. The level of alertness was so pervasive that it took him a few moments to grasp it, like the eyes of his own security guard, looking for trouble. Well, that made sense. The incident on Temple Mount had not sparked a wave of violence, but such a wave was expected. It did not surprise Ryan that the people in his sight failed to recognize the greater threat to them that came from the absence of violence. Israel had a myopia of outlook that was not hard to comprehend. The Israelis, surrounded by countries that had every reason to see the Jewish state immolated, had elevated paranoia to an art form and national security to an obsession. 1,900 years after Masada and the diaspora, they'd returned to a land they'd consecrated, fleeing oppression and genocide, only to invite more of the same. The difference was that they now held the sword, and had well and truly learned its use. But that, too, was a dead end. Wars were supposed to end in peace, but none of their wars had really ended. They'd stopped, been interrupted, no more than that. For Israel, peace had been nothing more than an intermission, time to bury the dead and train the next class of fighters. The Jews had fled from near extermination at Christian hands, betting their existence on their ability to defeat Muslim nations that had at once voiced their desire to finish what Hitler had started. And God probably thought exactly what he had thought during the Crusades. Unfortunately, parting seas and fixing the sun in the sky seemed to be things of the Old Testament. Men were supposed to settle things now. But men didn't always do what they were supposed to do. When Thomas More had written Utopia, the state in which men acted morally in all cases, he had given both the place and the book the same title. The meaning of Utopia is no place. Jack shook his head and turned a corner down another street of white-painted stucco buildings.
Hello, Dr. Ryan.
The man was in his middle 50s, shorter than Jack and more heavyset. He had a full beard, neatly trimmed, but speckled with gray, and looked less like a Jew than a unit commander in Sennacherib's Assyrian army. A broadsword or mace would not have been out of place in his hand. Had he not been smiling, Ryan would have wanted John Clark at his side. Hello, Avi. Fancy meeting you here. General Abraham Ben-Yaqob was Ryan's counterpart in the Mossad, assistant director of the Israeli Foreign Intelligence Agency. A serious player in the intelligence trade, Avi had been a professional army officer until 1968, a paratrooper with extensive special operations experience who'd been talent scouted by Rafi Eitan and brought into the fold. His path had crossed Ryan's half a dozen times in the past few years, but always in Washington, Ryan had the utmost respect for Ben Yacob as a professional. He wasn't sure what Avi thought of him. General Ben Yacob was very effective at concealing his thoughts and feelings. What is the news from Washington, Jack? All I know is what I saw on CNN at the embassy. Nothing official yet. And even if there were, you know the rules better than I do, Avi. Is there a good place to eat around here? That had already been planned, of course. 2 minutes and 100 yards later, they were in the back room of a quiet mom-and-pop place where both men's security guards could keep an eye on things. Ben Yacob ordered 2 Heinekens.
Where you're going, they do not serve beer.
Tacky, Avi. Very tacky, Ryan replied after his first sip.
You are taking Alden's place in Riyadh, I understand.
How could the likes of me ever take Dr. Alden's place anywhere?
You will be making your presentation about the same time Adler makes his. We are interested to hear it. In that case, you will not mind waiting, I guess. No preview. Not even one professional to another.
Especially not one professional to another. Jack drank his beer right out of the bottle. The menu, he saw, was in Hebrew.
Guess I'll have to let you order. That damned fool. I've been left holding the bag before, but never one this big.
Alden. It was not a question.
He's my age. Good God, he should know that experienced women are both more reliable and more knowledgeable.
Even in affairs of the heart, his terminology was professional. He might even pay more attention to his wife. Ben Yacob grinned.
I keep forgetting how Catholic you are.
That's not it, Avi. What lunatic wants more than one woman in his life? Ryan asked, deadpan.
He's gone. That's the evaluation of our embassy.
But what does that mean?
Maybe so. Nobody asked me for an opinion.
I really respect the guy. He gives the president good advice. He listens to us, and when he disagrees with the agency, he generally has a good reason for doing so. He caught me short on something 6 months back. The man is brilliant. But playing around like that... Well, I guess we all have our faults. What a damn fool reason to lose a job like that. Can't keep his pants zipped. And what timing, Jack raged at himself.
Such people cannot be in government service. They are too easy to compromise.
The Russians are getting away from honey traps. And the girl was Jewish, wasn't she? One of yours, Avi?
Dr. Ryan, would I do such a thing?
If a bear could laugh, it would have sounded like Avi Ben Yacob's outburst. Can't be your operation. There was evidently no attempt at blackmail. Jack nearly crossed the line with that one. The general's eyes narrowed.
It was not our operation. You think us mad. Dr. Elliot will replace Alden.
Ryan looked up from his beer. He hadn't thought about that. Oh, shit.
Both your friend. And ours, Avi pointed out.
How many government ministers have you disagreed with in the last 20 years, Avi?
None, of course.
Ryan snorted and finished off the bottle. What was that you said earlier? The part about one professional to another, remember?
We both do the same thing. Sometimes, when we are very lucky, they listen to us.
And some of the times they listen to us, we are the ones who are wrong. General Ben Yacob didn't alter his steady, relaxed gaze into Ryan's face when he heard that. It was yet another sign of Ryan's growing maturity. He genuinely liked Ryan as a man and as a professional, but personal likes and dislikes had little place in the intelligence trade. Something fundamental was happening. Scott Adler had been to Moscow. Both he and Ryan had visited Cardinal D'Antonio in the Vatican. As originally planned, Ryan was supposed to backstop Adler here with the Israeli Foreign Ministry, but Alden's astounding faux pas had changed that. Even for an intelligence professional, Avi Ben-Yakob was a singularly well-informed man. Ryan waffled on the question of whether or not Israel was America's most dependable ally in the Middle East. That was to be expected from an historian, Avi judged. Whatever Ryan thought, most Americans did regard Israel that way, and as a result, Israelis heard more from inside the American government than any other country. More even than the British, who had a formal relationship with the American intelligence community. Those sources had informed Ben-Yakob's intelligence officers that Ryan was behind what was going on. That seemed incredibly unlikely. Jack was very bright, almost as smart as Alden, for example, but Ryan had also defined his own role as a servant, not a master, an implementer of policy, not a maker of it. Besides, the American president did not like Ryan, and had not hidden the fact from his inner circle. Elizabeth Elliot was reported to hate him, Avi knew. Something that had happened before the election, an imagined slight, a harsh word. Well, government ministers were notoriously touchy. Not like Ryan and me, General Ben-Yakob thought. Both he and Ryan had faced death more than once, and perhaps that was their bond. They didn't have to agree on everything. There was respect between them. Moscow, Rome, Tel Aviv, Riyadh. What could he deduce from that? Scott Adler was Secretary of State Talbot's picked man, a highly skilled professional diplomat. Talbot was also bright. President Fowler might not have been terribly impressive, but he had selected superior cabinet officers and personal advisers. Except for Elliot, Avi corrected himself. Talbot used Deputy Secretary Adler to do his important advance work, and when Talbot himself entered formal negotiations, Adler was always at his side. The most amazing thing, of course, was that not one of the Mossad's informants had a clue what was going on. Something important in the Middle East, they said. Not sure what. I heard that Jack Ryan at the agency had something to do with it. End of report. It should have been infuriating, but Avi was used to that. Intelligence was a game where you never saw all the cards. Ben-Yakob's brother was a pediatrician with similar problems. A sick child rarely told him what was wrong. Of course, his brother could always ask, or point, or probe. Jack, I must tell my superiors something, General Ben-Yakob said plaintively. Come on, General. Jack turned and waved for another beer. Tell me, what the hell happened on the Mount?
The man was... he's deranged. In the hospital, they have a suicide watch on him. His wife had just left him. He came under the influence of a religious fanatic and...
Ben-Yakob shrugged.
It was terrible to see.
That's true, Avi. Do you have any idea the political fix you're in now?
Jack, we've been dealing with this problem for...
I thought so. Avi, you are one very bright spook, but you do not know what's happening this time. You really don't.
So tell me.
I didn't mean that, and you know it. What happened a couple days ago has changed things forever, General. You must know that.
Changed to what?
You're going to have to wait. I have my orders, too.
Does your country threaten us?
Threaten? That will never happen, Avi. How could it? Ryan warned himself that he was talking too much. This guy is good, Jack reminded himself.
But you cannot dictate policy to us.
Jack bit off his reply. You're very clever, General, but I still have my orders. You have to wait. I'm sorry that your people in D.C. can't help you, but neither can I. Ben-Yakob changed tack yet again.
I'm even buying you a meal, and my country is not so rich as yours."
Jack laughed at his tone. "Good beer, too. And as you say, I can't do this where you say I'm going. If that's where I'm going. Your air crew has already filed the flight plan. I checked." So much for secrecy. Jack accepted the new bottle with a smile for the waiter. "Avi, let it rest for a while. Do you really think that we'd do anything to compromise your country's security?" Yes, the general thought, but he couldn't say that, of course. Instead, he said nothing. But Ryan wasn't buying, and used the silence to change the course of the discussion himself. "I hear you're a grandfather now." "Yes. My daughter added to the gray in my beard. A daughter of her own. Leia." "You have my word. Leia will have a secure country to grow up in, Avi."
"And who will see to that?" Ben Yaakob asked.
"The same people who always have." Ryan congratulated himself for the answer. The poor guy really was desperate for information, and he was sad that Avi had made it so obvious. Well, even the best of us can be pushed into corners. Ben Yaakob made a mental note to have the file on Ryan updated. The next time they met, he wanted to have better information. The general wasn't a man who enjoyed losing at anything. Dr. Charles Alden contemplated his office. He wasn't leaving quite yet, of course. It would harm the Fowler administration. His resignation, signed and sitting on the green desk blotter, was for the end of the month. But that was just for show. As of today, his duties were at an end. He'd show up, read the briefing papers, scribble his notes, but Elizabeth Elliot would do the briefs now. The president had been regretful, but his usual cool self. "Sorry to lose you, Charlie, really sorry, especially now. But I'm afraid there's just no other way." He'd managed to retain his dignity in the Oval Office despite the rage he'd felt. Even Arnie Van Damme had been human enough to observe, "Oh shit, Charlie." Though enraged at the political damage to his boss, Van Damme had at least mixed a little humanity and locker room sympathy with his anger. But not Bob Fowler, champion of the poor and the helpless. It was worse with Liz. That arrogant bitch, with her silence and her eloquent eyes. She'd get the credit for what he had done. She knew it, and was already basking in it. The announcement would be made in the morning. It had already been leaked to the press. By whom was anyone's guess? Elliot, displaying her satisfaction? Arnie Van Damme, in a rapid effort at damage control? One of a dozen others? The transition from power to obscurity comes fast in Washington. The embarrassed look on the face of his secretary, the forced smiles of the other bureaucrats in the West Wing. But obscurity comes only after a blaze of publicity to announce the fact. Like the flare of light from an exploding star, public death is preceded by dazzling fanfare. That was the media's job. The phone was ringing off the hook. There had been 20 of them waiting outside his house in the morning, cameras at the ready, sun-like lights blazing in his face. And knowing what it had to be, even before the first question. That foolish little bitch, with her cow-like eyes and cow-like udders and broad cow-like hips. How could he have been so stupid? Professor Charles Winston Alden sat in his expensive chair and stared at his expensive desk. His head was bursting with a headache that he attributed to stress and anger, and he was right. But he failed to allow for the fact that his blood pressure was nearly double what it should have been, driven to new heights by the stress of the moment. He similarly failed to consider the fact that he had not taken his antihypertensive medication in the past week. A prototypical professor, he was always forgetting the little things, while his methodical mind picked apart the most intricate of problems. And so it came as a surprise. It started at an existing weakness in part of the circle of Willis, the brain's own blood beltway, designed to get blood to any part of the brain as a means of bypassing vessels that might become blocked with age. The vessel carried a huge amount of blood. 20 years of high blood pressure, and 20 years of his taking his medication only when he remembered that he had an upcoming doctor's appointment, and the added stress of seeing his career stop with a demeaning personal disgrace, culminated in a rupture of the vessel on the right side of his head. What had been a searing migraine headache became death itself. Alden's eyes opened wide, and his hands flew up to grasp his skull as though to hold it together. It was too late for that. The rip widened, allowing more blood to escape. This both deprived important parts of his brain of the oxygen needed to function, and further boosted intracranial pressure to the point that other brain cells were squeezed to extinction. Though paralyzed, Alden did not lose consciousness for quite some time, and his brilliant mind recorded the event with remarkable clarity. Already unable to move, he knew that death was coming for him. So close, he thought, his mind racing to outrun death.
35 years to get here. All those books, all those seminars, the bright young students, the lecture circuit, the talk shows, the campaigns, all to get here. I was so close to accomplishing something important. Oh, God, to die now, to die like this.
But he knew that death was here, that he had to accept it. He hoped that someone would forgive him. He hadn't been a bad man, had he? He'd tried so hard to make a difference, to make the world a better place, and now on the brink of something really important. So much the better for everyone if this had happened while mounted on that foolish little cow. Better still, he knew in one final moment, if his studies and his intellect had been his only pass. Alden's disgrace and de facto firing determined the fact that his death would take long to discover. Instead of being buzzed by his secretary every few minutes, it took nearly an hour. Because she was intercepting all calls to him, none were forwarded. It would not have mattered in any case, though it would cause his secretary some guilt for weeks to come. Finally, when she was ready to leave for the day, she decided that she had to tell him so. She buzzed him over the intercom and got no response. Frowning, she paused, then buzzed him again. Still nothing. She next rose and walked to the door, knocking on it. Finally, she opened it and screamed loudly enough that the Secret Service agents outside the Oval Office in the opposite corner of the building heard her. The first to arrive was Helen D'Agostino, one of the president's personal bodyguards, who'd been walking the corridors to loosen up after sitting most of the day.
Shit!
And that fast her service revolver was out. She'd never seen so much blood in her life, all coming out of Alden's right ear and puddling on his desk. She shouted an alert over her radio transmitter. It had to be a headshot. Her sharp eyes swept the room, tracking over the front sight of her Model 19 Smith & Wesson. Windows intact. She darted across the room. Nobody here. So, what then? Next, she felt with her left hand for Alden's pulse on the carotid artery. Of course there was none, but training dictated that she had to check. Outside the room, all exits to the White House were blocked, guns were drawn, and visitors froze in their tracks. Secret Service agents were conducting a thorough check of the entire building.
God damn,
Pete Connor observed as he entered the room. Sweep is complete, a voice told both of them through their earpieces. Building is clear. Hawk is secure. Hawk was the president's code name with the Secret Service. It displayed the agent's institutional sense of humor, both for its association with the president's name and its ironic dissonance with his politics. Ambulance is 2 minutes out, the communications center added. They could get an ambulance faster than a helicopter.
Stand easy, Daga, Connor said. I think the man had a stroke.
Move!
This was a Navy chief medical corpsman. The Secret Service agents were trained in first aid, of course, but the White House always had a medical team standing by, and the corpsman was first on the scene. He carried the sort of duffel bag carried by a corpsman in the field, but didn't bother opening it. There was just too much blood on the desk, he saw instantly, and the top of the puddle was congealing. The corpsman decided not to disturb the body. It was a potential crime scene, and the Secret Service guys had briefed him on that set of rules. Most of the blood had come out Dr. Alden's right ear. There was a trickle from the left one also, and post-mortem lividity was already starting in what parts of the face he could see. Diagnosis didn't come much easier than that. He's dead. Probably been close to an hour, guys. Cerebral hemorrhage. Stroke. Isn't this guy a hypertensive?
Yeah. I think so,
Special Agent D'Agostino said after a moment. You'll have to post him to be sure, but that's what he died of. Blowout. A physician arrived next. He was a Navy captain and confirmed his chief's observation.
This is Connor. Tell the ambulance to take it easy. Pilgrim is dead. Looks like from natural causes.
Repeat, Pilgrim is dead, the principal agent said over his radio. The post-mortem examination would check for many things, of course. Poison, possible contamination of his food or water. But the White House environment was monitored on a continuous basis. D'Agostino and Connor shared a look. Yes, he had suffered from high blood pressure, and he sure as hell had had a bad day. Just about as bad as they get. How is he? Heads turned. It was Hawk, the president himself, with a literal ring of agents around him, pressing through the door. And Dr. Elliot behind him. D'Agostino made a mental note that they'd have to make up a new code name for her. She wondered if Harpy might suffice. Dagga didn't like the bitch. No one on the presidential security detail did. But they weren't paid to like her, or for that matter, even to like the president.
He's dead, Mr. President, the doctor said. It appears he suffered a massive stroke.
The president took the news without a visible reaction. The Secret Service agents reminded themselves that he'd seen his wife through a multi-year battle against multiple sclerosis, finally losing her while still governor of Ohio. It must have drained the man, they thought, wanting it to be true. It must have stripped all of his emotions away. Certainly, there were few emotions left in him. He made a clucking sound, and grimaced, and shook his head, and then he turned away. Liz Elliott took his place, peering over the shoulder of an agent. Helen D'Agostino examined her face as Elliot pressed forward to get her look. Elliot liked to wear makeup, Dagga knew, and she watched the new national security advisor pale beneath it. Certainly, it was a horrible scene, D'Agostino knew. It looked as though a bucket of red paint had been spilled on the desk.
Oh, God,
Dr. Elliot whispered.
Out of the way, please, called a new voice.
It was an agent with a stretcher. He pushed Liz Elliott roughly out of the way. Dagga noticed that she was too shocked to be angry at that, that her face was still very white, her eyes unfocused. She might think she's a tough bitch, Special Agent D'Agostino thought, but she's not as tough as she thinks. The thought gave the agent satisfaction.
Little weak at the knees, eh, Liz?
Helen D'Agostino, 1 month out of the Secret Service Academy, had been out on a discreet surveillance when the subject, a counterfeiter, had made her, and for some reason she'd never understood, come out with a large automatic pistol. He'd even fired a round in her direction. No more than that, though. She'd earned her nickname, Dagga, by drawing her S&W and landing 3 right in the poor bastard's 10 ring at a range of 37 feet, just like a cardboard target at the range. Just that easy, too. She'd never even dreamed about it. And so Dagga was one of the guys, a member of the service pistol team when they'd outshot the Army's elite Delta Force commandos. Dagga was tough. Clearly, Liz Elliott was not, however arrogant she might be.
No guts, lady.
It did not occur to Special Agent Helen D'Agostino at that moment that Liz Elliott was Hawk's chief advisor for national security.
It had been a quiet meeting, the first such meeting that Gunter Bach remembered. None of the blustering rhetoric so beloved of the revolutionary soldiers. His old comrade in arms, Ismail Kati, was normally a firebrand,
eloquent in 5 languages, but Conti was subdued in every way, Bach saw. The ferocity of his smile was not there. The sweeping gestures that had always punctuated his words were more restrained, and Bach wondered if the man might not be feeling well.
I grieved when I heard the news of your wife, Conti said, turning to personal matters for a moment. Thank you, my friend.
Bach decided to put his best face on it.
It is a small thing compared to what your people have endured. There are always setbacks.
There were more than a few in this case, and both knew it. Their best weapon had always been solid intelligence information. But Bach's had dried up. The Red Army faction had drawn for years on all sorts of information. Its own people within the West German government, useful tidbits from the East German intelligence apparat, and all the Eastern Bloc clones of their common master, the KGB. Doubtless a good deal of their data had come from Moscow, routed through the smaller nations for political reasons that Bach had never questioned. After all, world socialism is itself a struggle with numerous tactical moves.
Used to be, he corrected himself. It was all gone now, the help upon which he'd been able to draw.
The East Bloc intelligence services had turned on their revolutionary comrades like cur dogs. The Czechs and Hungarians had literally sold information on them to the West. The East Germans had given it away in the name of greater German cooperation and brotherhood. East Germany, the German Democratic Republic, no longer existed. Now it was a mere appendage to capitalist Germany. And the Russians, whatever indirect support they'd ever had from the Soviets was gone, possibly forever. With the demise of socialism in Europe, their sources within various government institutions had been rolled up, turned double agent, or simply stopped delivering, having lost their faith in a socialist future. At a stroke, the best and most useful weapon of the European revolutionary fighters had disappeared. Fortunately, it was different here. Different for Kati. The Israelis were as foolish as they were vicious. The one constant thing in the world, both Bach and Kati knew, was the inability of the Jews to make any kind of meaningful political initiative. Formidable as they were at the business of war, they had always been hopelessly inept at the business of peace. Added to that was their ability to dictate policy to their own masters as though they didn't want peace at all. Bach was not a student of world history, but he doubted that there was any precedent for such behavior as this. The ongoing revolt of both indigenous Israeli Arabs and Palestinian captives in the occupied territories was a bleeding sore on the soul of Israel. Once able to infiltrate Arab groups at will, Israeli police and domestic intelligence agencies were gradually being shut out, as popular support for this rebellion became more and more fixed in the minds of their enemies. At least Kati had an ongoing operation to command. Bach envied him that, however bad the tactical situation might be. Another perverse advantage for Kati was the efficiency of his enemy. Israeli intelligence had waged its shadow war against the Arab freedom fighters for 2 generations now. Over that time, the foolish ones had died by the guns of Mossad officers. Those still alive, like Kati, were the survivors, the strong, clever, dedicated products of a Darwinian selection process.
How are you dealing with informers? Bach asked.
We found one last week, Kati answered with a cruel smile. He identified his case officer before he died. Now we have him under surveillance.
Bach nodded. Once the Israeli officer would merely have been assassinated, but Kati had learned. By watching him, very carefully and only intermittently, they might identify other infiltrators.
And the Russians?
This question got a strong reaction.
The pigs. They give us nothing of value. We are on our own. It has always been so.
Kati's face showed what had today been rare animation. It came, then went, and the Arab's face lapsed back into enveloping fatigue.
You seem tired, my friend. It has been a long day. For you also, I think.
Bach allowed himself a yawn and a stretch.
Until tomorrow.
Kati rose with a nod, guiding his visitor to his room. Bach took his hand before retiring. They'd known each other for almost 20 years. Kati returned to the living room and walked outside. His security people were in place and alert. Kati spoke with them briefly, as always, because loyalty resulted from attention to the needs of one's people. Then he, too, went to bed. He paused for evening prayers, of course. It troubled him vaguely that his friend Gunther was an unbeliever. Brave, clever, dedicated though he was, he had no faith, and Kati did not understand how any man could carry on without that.
Carry on? Does he carry on at all?
Kati asked himself as he lay down. His aching legs and arms at last knew rest, and though the pain in them didn't end, at least it changed. Bach was finished, wasn't he? Better for him if Petra had died at the hands of GSG-9. They must have wanted to kill her, those German commandos, but the rumor was that they'd found her with a babe suckling on each breast, and you could not be a man and kill such a picture as that. Kati himself, for all his hatred for Israelis, could not do that. It would be an offense at God himself. Petra, he thought, smiling in the dark. He'd taken her once, when Gunther had been away. She'd been lonely, and he'd been hot-blooded from a successful operation in Lebanon, the killing of an Israeli advisor to the Christian militia, and so they'd shared their revolutionary fervor for 2 blazing hours.
Does Gunther know?
Did Petra tell him? Perhaps she did. It wouldn't matter. Bach was not that sort of man. Not like an Arab for whom it would have been a blood insult. Europeans were so casual about such things. It was a curiosity to Kati that they should be that way. But there were many curiosities in life. Bach was a true friend. Of that, he was sure. The flame burned in Gunther's soul as truly and brightly as it did in his own. It was sad that events in Europe had made life so hard on his friend. His woman caged, his children stolen. The very thought of it chilled Kati's blood. It was foolish of them to have brought children into the world. Kati had never married, and enjoyed the company of women rarely enough. In Lebanon 10 years earlier, all those European girls, some in their teens even. He remembered with a quiet smile. Things no Arab girl would ever learn to do. So hot-blooded they'd been, wanting to show how dedicated they were. He knew that they had used him as surely as he'd used them. But Kati had been younger then, with a young man's passions. Those passions were gone. He wondered if they would ever return. He hoped they would. He hoped mainly that he'd recover well enough that he'd have the energy for more than one thing. Treatment was going well, the doctor said. He was tolerating it much better than most. If he always felt tired, if the crippling bouts of nausea came from time to time, he mustn't be discouraged. That was normal. No, the normal way of things was not even so good as this. There was real hope, the doctor assured him on every visit. It wasn't merely the things any doctor would say to encourage his patient, the doctor had told him last week. He was truly doing well. He had a good chance. The important thing, Kati knew, was that he had something still to live for. He had purpose. That, he was sure, was the thing keeping him alive. What's the score?
Just carry on, Dr. Cabot replied over the secure satellite link. Charlie had a massive stroke at his desk.
A pause.
Maybe the best thing that could have happened to the poor bastard.
Liz Elliott taking over?
That's right.
Ryan compressed his lips into a tight grimace, as though he'd just taken some particularly foul medicine. He checked his watch. Cabot had arisen early to make the call and give the instructions. He and his boss were not exactly friends,
but the importance of this mission had overcome that. Maybe it would be the same with E.E., Ryan told himself.
Okay, boss. I take off in 90 minutes, and we deliver our pitches simultaneously, as per the plan. Good luck, Jack.
Thank you, Director. Ryan punched the off button on the secure phone console. He walked out of the communications room and back to his room. His bag was already packed. All he had to do was knot his tie. The coat went over his shoulder. It was too hot here for that, and hotter still where he was going. He'd have to wear a coat there. It was expected, one of those curious rules of formal behavior that demanded the maximum discomfort to attain the proper degree of decorum. Ryan lifted his bag and left the room. Synchronize our watches? Adler was waiting outside and chuckled. Hey, Scott, that isn't my idea.
It does make sense. Kinda.
I suppose. Well, I got an airplane to catch.
Can't take off without you, Adler pointed out.
One advantage to government service, isn't it? Ryan looked up and down the corridor. It was empty, though he wondered if the Israelis had managed to bug it. If so, the Muzak might interfere with their bugs.
What do you think?
Even money.
That good?
Yeah, Adler said with a grin. This is the one, Jack. It was a good idea you had.
Not just mine. I'll never get any credit for it anyway. Nobody'll ever know.
We'll know. Let's get to work.
Let me know how they react. Good luck, man.
I think Mazel Tov is the proper expression.
Adler took Ryan's hand.
Good flight.
The embassy limo took Ryan directly to the aircraft, whose engines were already turning. He had had priority clearance to taxi and was airborne in less than 5 minutes from the time he boarded. The VC-20B headed south, down the dagger shape that was Israel, then east over the Gulf of Aqaba and into Saudi airspace. As was his custom, Ryan stared out the window. His mind went over what he was supposed to do, but that had been rehearsed for over a week, and his brain could do that quietly while Ryan stared. The air was clear. The sky virtually cloudless as they flew over what was to all appearances a barren wasteland of sand and rock. What color there was came from stunted bushes too small to pick out individually, and had the general effect of an unshaven face. Jack knew that much of Israel looked exactly the same, as did the Sinai, where all those tank battles had been fought, and he found himself wondering why men chose to die for land like this. But they had. For almost as long as man had existed on the planet. Man's first organized wars had been fought here, and they hadn't stopped. At least, not yet. Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, is roughly in the center of that country, which is as large as all of America east of the Mississippi. The executive aircraft made a relatively fast descent, allowed by the modest amount of air traffic here, and the air was agreeably smooth as the pilot brought the aircraft low into the Riyadh International. In another few minutes, the Gulfstream taxied toward the cargo terminal, and the attendant opened the forward door. After 2 hours' exposure to air conditioning, Jack felt as though he'd stepped into a blast furnace. The shade temperature was over 110, and there was no shade. Worse, the sun reflected off the pavement, as though from a mirror, so intensely that Ryan's face stung from it. There to greet him was the deputy chief of mission at the embassy and the usual security people. In a moment, he was sweating inside yet another embassy limo.
Good flight, the DCM asked.
Not bad. Everything ready here?
Yes, sir.
It was nice to be called sir, Jack thought.
Well, let's get on with it. My instructions are to accompany you as far as the door.
That's right.
You might be interested to know that we haven't had any press inquiries. DC has kept this one pretty quiet.
That'll change in about 5 hours. Riyadh was a clean city, though quite different from Western metropolises. The contrast with Israeli towns was remarkable. Nearly everything was new. Only 2 hours away, but that was by air.
This place had never been the crossroads Palestine had been. The ancient trading routes had given the brutal heat of Arabia a wide berth, and though the coastal fishing and trading towns had known prosperity for millennia, the nomadic people of the interior had lived a stark existence, held together only by their Islamic faith, which was in turn anchored by the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. Two things had changed that. The British in the First World War had used this area as a diversion against Ottoman Turkey, drawing their forces here and away from sites which might have been of greater utility to their allies in Germany and Austria-Hungary. Then in the 1930s, oil had been discovered. Oil in quantities so vast as to make Texas an apostrophe. With that, first the Arab world had changed, and then the whole world had soon followed. From the first, the relationship between the Saudis and the West had been delicate. The Saudis were still a curious mixture of the primitive and the sophisticated. Some people on this peninsula were but a single generation from nomadic life that was little different from that of the wanderers of the Bronze Age. At the same time, there was an admirable tradition of Quranic scholarship, a code that was harsh but scrupulously fair, and remarkably similar to the Talmudic traditions of Judaism. In a brief span of time, these people had become accustomed to wealth beyond count or meaning. Viewed as comic wastrels by the sophisticated West, they were merely the newest entry in a long line of nouveau riche nations of which America had been a recent part. A nouveau riche himself, Ryan smiled at some of the buildings in sympathy. People with old money, earned by bumptious ancestors whose rough manners had long since been conveniently forgotten, were always uncomfortable around those who had made, not inherited, their comforts. As it was with individuals, so it was with nations. The Saudis and their Arab brethren were still learning how to be a nation, much less a rich and influential one, but the process was an exciting one for them and their friends. They'd had some easy lessons, and some very hard ones, most recently with their neighbors to the north. For the most part, they had learned well, and now Ryan hoped that the next step would be as easily made. A nation achieves greatness by helping others to make peace, not by demonstrating prowess at war or commerce. To learn that, it had taken America from the time of Washington to the time of Theodore Roosevelt, whose Nobel Peace Prize adorned the wall in the White House room that still bore his name. It took us almost 120 years, Jack thought as the car turned and slowed. Teddy got the prize for arbitrating some little pissant border dispute, and we're asking these folks to help us settle the most dangerous flashpoint in the civilized world after merely 50 years of effective nationhood. What reason do we have to look down on these people? There is a choreography to occasions of state as delicate and as adamant as any ballet. The car, it used to be a carriage, arrives. The door is opened by a functionary, who used to be called a footman. The official waits in dignified solitude while the visitor alights from the car. The visitor nods to the footman if he's polite, and Ryan was. Another, more senior functionary first greets the visitor, then conducts him to the official. On both sides of the entryway are the official guards, who were in this case uniformed, armed soldiers. Photographers had been left out for obvious reasons. Such affairs would be more comfortable in temperatures under 100 degrees, but at least here there was shade from a canopy, as Ryan was conducted to his official.
"Welcome to my country, Dr. Ryan."
Prince Ali bin Sheikh extended a firm hand to Jack.
"Thank you, Your Highness. Would you follow me?"
"Gladly, sir. Before I melt." Ali led Jack and the DCM inside, where they parted ways. The building was a palace. Riyadh had quite a few palaces, since there were so many royal princes, but Ryan thought working palace might have been a more accurate term. It was smaller than the British counterparts Ryan had visited, and cleaner, Jack saw somewhat to his surprise. Probably because of the cleaner and drier air of the region, which contrasted to the damp, sooty atmosphere of London. It was also air-conditioned. The inside temperature could not have been far above 85, which somehow seemed comfortable to Ryan. The prince was dressed in flowing robes with a headdress held atop his head by a pair of circular... What? Ryan wondered. He ought to have gotten briefed on that, Jack thought too late. Alden was supposed to have done this anyway. Charlie knew this area far better than he did, and... But Charlie Alden was dead, and Jack was carrying the ball. Ali bin Sheikh was referred to at State and CIA as a prince without portfolio. Taller, thinner, and younger than Ryan, he advised the King of Saudi Arabia on foreign affairs and intelligence matters. Probably the Saudi intelligence services, British-trained, reported to him, but that was not as clear as it should have been. Doubtless another legacy of the Brits, who took their secrecy far more seriously than Americans. Though the file on Ali was a thick one, it mainly dealt with his background. Educated at Cambridge, he'd become an army officer, and continued his professional studies at Leavenworth and Carlisle Barracks in the United States. At Carlisle, he'd been the youngest man in his class, a colonel at 27. To be a royal prince was career-enhancing, and finished third in a group whose top 10 graduates had each gone on to command a division or equivalent post. The army general who'd briefed Ryan on Ali remembered his classmate fondly as a young man of no mean intellectual gifts and superb command potential. Ali had played a major role in persuading the king to accept American aid during the Iraqi war. He was regarded as a serious player, quick to make decisions, and quicker still to express displeasure at having his time wasted, despite his courtly manners. The prince's office was easily identified by the two officers at the double doors. A third man opened them, bowing to both as they passed.
"I've heard much about you," Ali said casually.
"All good, I trust," Ryan replied, trying to be at ease. Ali turned with an impish smile.
"We have some mutual friends in Britain, Sir John. Do you keep current with your small arms skills?"
"I really don't have the time, sir." Ali waved Jack to a chair.
"For some things, one should make time."
Both sat, and things became formal. A servant appeared with a silver tray and poured coffee for both men before withdrawing.
"I sincerely regret the news on Dr. Alden. For so fine a man to be brought down so foolishly, may God have mercy on his soul. At the same time, I have looked forward to meeting you for some time, Dr. Ryan."
Jack sipped at his coffee. It was thick, bitter, and hideously strong. "Thank you, Your Highness. Thank you also for agreeing to see me in the place of a more senior official."
"The most effective efforts at diplomacy often begin informally. So, how may I be of service?"
Ali smiled and leaned back in his chair. The fingers of his left hand toyed with his beard. His eyes were as dark as flint, and though they seemed to gaze casually at his visitor, the atmosphere in the room was now businesslike. And that, Ryan saw, was fast enough. "My country wishes to explore a means of...
that is, the rough outline of a plan with which to alleviate tensions in this area. With Israel, of course. Adler, I presume, is delivering the same proposal to the Israelis at this moment."
"Correct, Your Highness."
"That is dramatic," the prince observed with an amused smile. "Do go on."
Jack began his pitch. "Sir, our foremost consideration in this matter must be the physical security of the State of Israel. Before either of us was born, America and other countries stood by and did very little to prevent the extermination of 6 million Jews. The guilt attending that infamy lies heavy on my country." Ali nodded gravely before speaking.
"I have never understood that. Perhaps you might have done better, but the strategic decisions made during the war by Roosevelt and Churchill were made in good faith. The issue with the shipload of Jews that nobody wanted prior to the outbreak of war, of course, is another issue entirely. I find it very strange indeed that your country did not grant asylum to those poor people. Fundamentally, however, no one saw what was coming. Not the Jews, nor the Gentiles,
and by the time it became clear what was happening, Hitler had physical control of Europe, and no direct intervention on your part was possible. Your leaders decided at that time that the best way to end the slaughter was to win the war as expeditiously as possible. That was logical. They might have made a political issue of the ongoing Endlösung, I believe the term was, but they decided that it would be ineffective from a practical point of view. That, in retrospect, was probably incorrect, but the decision was not made in malice. Ali paused to let his history lesson sink in for a moment. In any case, we understand and conditionally accept the reasons behind your national goal to preserve the State of Israel. Our acceptance, as I am sure you will understand, is conditional upon your recognition of other people's rights. This part of the world is not composed of Jews and savages. And that, sir, is the basis of our proposal, Ryan replied. If we can find a formula that recognizes those other rights, will you accept a plan in which America is the guarantor of Israeli security? Jack didn't have time to hold his breath for the reply. Of course. Have we not made that clear? Who else but America can guarantee the peace? If you must put troops in Israel to make them feel secure, if you must execute a treaty to formalize your guarantee, those are things we can accept. But what of Arab rights? What is your view of how we should address those rights? Jack asked. Prince Ali was stunned by the question. Was not Ryan's mission to present the American plan? He almost lapsed into anger, but Ali was too clever for that. It wasn't a trap he saw. It was a fundamental change in American policy. Dr. Ryan, you asked that question for a reason, but it was a rhetorical question nonetheless. I believe the answer to that question is yours to make. The answer took 3 minutes. Ali shook his head sadly. That, Dr. Ryan, is something we would probably find acceptable, but the Israelis will never agree to it even though we might. More precisely, they would reject it for the very reason that we would accept it. They should agree to it, of course, but they will not. Is it acceptable to your government, sir? I must, of course, present it to others, but I think our response would be favorable. Any objections at all? The prince paused to finish his coffee. He stared over Ryan's head toward something on the far wall. We could offer several modifications, none of them really substantive to the central thesis of your scheme. Actually, I think the negotiations on those minor issues would be easily and quickly accomplished, since they are not matters of consequence to the other interested parties. And who would be your choice for the Muslim representative? Ali leaned forward. That is simple. Anyone could tell you. The Imam of the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a distinguished scholar and linguist. His name is Ahmed bin Yusuf. Ahmed is consulted by scholars throughout Islam for his opinions on matters of theology. Sunni, Shia, all defer to him on selected issues. He is even a Palestinian by birth. That easy? Ryan closed his eyes and let out a breath. He'd guessed right on that one. Yusuf was not exactly a political moderate and had called for the expulsion of Israel from the West Bank, but he had also denounced terrorism per se on theological grounds. He wasn't quite perfect, but if the Muslims could live with him, he was perfect enough. You are very confident, Dr. Ryan. Ali shook his head. Too confident. I grant you that your plan is fairer than anything I or my government expected, but it will never happen. Ali paused again and fixed Ryan with his eyes. Now I must ask myself if this was ever a serious proposal, or merely something to give the appearance of fairness. Your Highness, President Fowler addresses the United Nations General Assembly next Thursday. He will present this very plan, live and in color. I am authorized to extend your government in